Anna came across the room to where Rosie and Pam were sitting. "What have you got there?" she asked Rosie. "A picture. I bought it this afternoon. It's for my new place, when I get it. My room." And then, a little fearfully, she added, "What do you think?"
"I don't know. Let's get it into the light."
Anna picked the picture up by the sides of the frame, carried it across the room, and set it on the ping-pong table. The five women gathered around it in a semicircle. No, Rosie saw, glancing around, now they were seven. Robin St. James and Consuelo Delgado had come downstairs and joined them. They were standing behind Cynthia, looking over her narrow, bird-boned shoulders. Rosie waited for someone to break the silence. She was betting on Cynthia. And when nobody did, and it began to spin out, she started feeling nervous. "Well," she asked at last, "what do you think? Somebody say something."
"It's an odd picture," Anna said.
"Yeah," Cynthia agreed. "Weird. I think I've seen one like it before, though."
Anna was looking at Rosie.
"Why did you buy it, Rosie?"
Rosie shrugged, feeling more nervous than ever. "I don't know that I can explain, really. It was like it called to me."
Anna surprised her and eased her considerably by smiling and nodding. "Yes, that's really all art is about, I think, and not just pictures. It's the same with books and stories and sculpture and even castles in the sand. Some things call to us, that's all. It's as if the people who made them were speaking inside our heads. But this particular painting, is it beautiful to you, Rosie?"
Rosie looked at it, trying to see it as she had in the Liberty City Loan and Pawn, when its silent tongue had spoken to her with such force that she had been stopped cold, all other thoughts driven from her mind. She looked at the blonde woman in the rose madder toga, or chiton, that was what Mr. Lefferts had called it, standing on the high grass at the top of the hill, again noting the plait which hung straight down the middle of her back and the gold armlet above her right elbow. Then she let her gaze move to the ruined temple and the tumbled god statue at the foot of the hill, the things the woman in the toga was looking at.
"How do you know that's what she's looking at? How can you know? You can't see her face."
That was true, of course. But what else was there to look at?
"No," Rosie said, "I didn't buy it because it was beautiful to me. I bought it because it seemed powerful to me. The way it stopped me in my tracks was powerful."
"Does a picture have to be beautiful to be good, do you think?"
"Nope," Consuela said. "Think about Jackson Pollock. His stuff wasn't about beauty, it was about energy. Or Diane Arbus, how about her?"
"Who's she?" Cynthia asked.
"A photographer who got famous taking pictures of women with beards and dwarves smoking cigarettes."
"Oh." Cynthia thought this over, and her face suddenly brightened with recollection.
"I saw this picture once at a catered party back when I was cocktailing. In an art gallery, this was. It was by some guy named Applethorpe, Robert Applethorpe. And you want to know what it was? One guy gobbling another guy's crank. Seriously. And it wasn't any fake job like in a Skin magazine either. I mean, that guy was making an effort. He was taking care of business and working overtime. You wouldn't think a guy could get that much of the old broom handle down his..."
"Mapplethorpe," Anna said dryly.
"Huh?
Mapplethorpe, not Applethorpe."
"Oh, yeah, I guess that's right."
"He's dead now."
"Oh, yeah?"
Cynthia asked.
"What got him?"
"AIDS." Anna was still looking at Rosie's picture and spoke absently. "Known as broom handle disease in some quarters."
"You said you saw a picture like Rosie's before," Gert rumbled. "Where was that squirt? Same art gallery?"
"No."
While discussing the Mapplethorpe, Cynthia had only looked interested. Now color pinked her cheeks and the corners of her mouth dimpled in a defensive little smile.
"And it wasn't, you know, really the same, but..."
"Go on, tell," Rosie said.
"Well, my dad was a Methodist minister back in Bakersfield," Cynthia said. "This is Bakersfield, California, where I came from. We lived in the parsonage, and there were all these old pictures in the little meeting room downstairs. Some were presidents, and some were flowers, and some were dogs. They didn't matter. They were just things to hang on the wall so they wouldn't look too bare.
Rosie nodded, thinking of the pictures which had surrounded hers on those dusty pawn shop shelves. Gondolas in Venice, fruit in bowls, dogs and foxes. Just things to hang on the wall so they wouldn't look too bare. Mouths without tongues.
But there was this one, it was called... She frowned, trying to remember. I think it was called De Soto Looks West. It showed this explorer in tin pants and a saucepan hat standing on top of a cliff with these Indians around him. And he was looking over all these miles of woods towards a great big river, the Mississippi, I guess. But see, the thing was... She looked at them uncertainly. Her cheeks were pinker than ever, and her smile was gone.
The bulky bandage over her ear seemed very white, very much there, like some sort of peculiar accessory which had been grafted onto the side of her head. And Rosie found time to wonder, not for the first time since she'd come to DNS, why so many men were so unkind. What was wrong with them? Was it something that had been left out, or something nasty which had been unaccountably built in, like a bad circuit in a computer?
Go on, Cynthia, Anna said. We won't laugh, will we?
The women shook their heads. Cynthia stuck her hands behind her back like a little girl who was being called upon to recite in front of the entire class. Well, she said, speaking in a much smaller voice than her usual one.
It was like the river was moving. That was the thing that fascinated me. The picture was in the room where my father had his Thursday night Bible school classes, and I'd go in there, and sometimes I'd sit in front of that picture for an hour or more, looking at it like it was television. I was watching the river move, or waiting to see if it would move. Now I can't remember which, but I was only 9 or 10. One thing I do remember is thinking that if it was moving, a raft or a boat or an Indian canoe would go by sooner or later, and then I'd know for sure. Except one day I went in, and the picture was gone. Poof. I think my mother must have looked in and seen me just sitting there in front of it, you know, and she got worried and took it away, Robin said. Yeah, probably threw it in the trash, Cynthia said. I was just a kid, but your picture reminds me of it, Rosie.
Pam peered at it closely.
Yep, she said.
No wonder.
I can see the woman breathing.
They all laughed then, and Rosie laughed with them.
No, it's not that, Cynthia said. It's just, it looks a little old-fashioned, you know? Like a schoolroom picture. And it's pale. Except for the clouds in her dress, the colors are pale. My De Soto picture, everything was pale except for the river. The river was bright silver. It looked more there than the rest of the picture.
Gert turned to Rosie.
Tell us about your job. I heard you say you got a job.
Tell us everything, Pam said.
Yes, Anna said. Tell us everything. And then I wonder if you could step into my office for a few minutes.
Is it what I've been waiting for?
Anna smiled.
As a matter of fact, I think it is.
It's an optimum room, one of the best on our list, and I hope you'll be as delighted as I am, Anna said. There was a stack of flyers perched precariously on the corner of her desk, announcing the forthcoming Daughters and Sisters Swing Into Summer picnic and concert, an event which was part fundraiser, part community relations, and part celebration. Anna took one, turned it over, and sketched quickly. Kitchen here, hide-a-bed here, and a little living room area here. This is the bathroom. It's hardly big enough to turn around in, and in order to sit on the commode, you'll practically have to put your feet in the shower. But it's yours.
Yes, Rosie murmured. Mine.
A feeling that she hadn't had in weeks. That all this was a wonderful dream, and at any moment she would wake up beside Norman again, was creeping over her. The view is nice. It's not Lake Drive, of course, but Bryant Park is very pretty, especially in the summer. Second floor. The neighborhood got a little ragged in the 80s, but it's pulling itself together again now.
It's as if you've stayed there yourself, Rosie said.
Anna shrugged, a slender, pretty gesture, and she drew the hall in front of the room, then a flight of stairs. She sketched with the no-frills economy of a draftsman. She spoke without looking up. I've been there on a good many occasions, she said, but of course that's not what you mean, is it?
No.
A little of me goes out with every woman when she leaves. I suppose that sounds corny, but I don't care. It's true. And that's all that really matters. So what do you think?
Rosie hugged her impulsively and instantly regretted it when she felt Anna stiffen. I shouldn't have done it, she thought as she let go. I knew better. And she had.
Anna Stevenson was kind. There was no doubt about that in Rosie's mind, maybe even saintly. But there was that strange arrogance. And there was this, too. Anna didn't like people in her space. Anna especially didn't like to be touched.
I'm sorry, she said, drawing back.
Don't be silly, Anna said brusquely. What do you think?
I love it, Rosie said.
Anna smiled, and the small awkwardness was behind them. She drew an X on the wall of the living room area near a tiny rectangle which represented the room's only window. Your new picture. I'll bet you decide it belongs right here.
I'll bet I do, too.
Anna put the pencil down. I'm delighted to be able to help you, Rosie, and I'm so glad you came to us. Here, you're leaking. It was the Kleenex again. But Rosie doubted it was the same box Anna had offered her during their first interview in this room. She had an idea that a lot of Kleenex got used in here. She took one and wiped her eyes.
You saved my life, you know, she said hoarsely. You saved my life, and I'll never, ever forget it.
Flattering, but inaccurate, Anna said in her dry, calm voice. I saved your life no more than Cynthia flipped Gert downstairs in the rec room. You saved your own life when you took a chance and walked out on the man who was hurting you.
Just the same, thank you. Just for being here.
You're very welcome, Anna said. And for the only time during her stay at DNS, Rosie saw tears standing in Anna Stevenson's eyes. She handed the box of Kleenex back across the desk with a little smile.
Here, she said. Looks like you've sprung a leak yourself.
Anna laughed, took a Kleenex, used it, and tossed it in the wastebasket. I hate to cry. It's my deepest, darkest secret. Every now and then I think I'm done with it, that I must be done with it, and then I do it again. It's sort of the way I feel about men.
For another brief moment, Rosie found herself thinking about Bill Steiner and his hazel eyes.
Anna took the pencil again and scratched something below the rough floor plan she'd drawn. Then she handed the sheet to Rosie. It was an address she'd jotted down, 897 Trenton Street. That's where you live, Anna said. It's most of the way across the city from here, but you can use the buses now, can't you? Smiling and still crying a little, Rosie nodded. You may give that address to some of the friends you've made here, and eventually to friends you make beyond here. But right now, nobody knows but the two of us. What she was saying felt like a set piece to Rosie, a goodbye speech. People who show up at your place will not have found out how to get there at this place. It's just how we do things at DNS. After 20 years of working with abused women, I'm convinced it's the only way to do things. Pam had explained all this to Rosie, so had Consuela Delgado and Robin St. James. These explanations had taken place during Big Fun Hour, which was what the residents called evening chores at DNS, but Rosie hadn't really needed them. It only took 3 or 4 therapy sessions in the front room for a person of reasonable intelligence to learn most of what she needed to know about the protocols of the house. There was Anna's list, and there were also Anna's rules. How worried are you about him? Anna asked. Rosie's attention had wandered a little. Now it snapped back in a hurry. At first, she wasn't even sure who Anna was talking about. Your husband, how worried are you? I know that in your first 2 or 3 weeks here, you expressed fears that he would come after you, that he'd track you down, in your words. How do you feel about that now? Rosie considered the question carefully.
First of all, fear was an inadequate word to express her feelings about Norman during her first week or two at DNS. Even terror didn't completely serve, because the core of her feelings concerning him was lapped about, and to some degree altered, by other emotions. Shame at having failed in her marriage, homesickness for a few possessions she had cared deeply about, Pooh's chair, for instance, a sensation of euphoric freedom which seemed to renew itself at some point each day, and a relief so cold it was somehow horrible. The sort of relief a wire walker might feel after tottering at the furthest edge of balance while crossing a deep canyon, and then recovering. Fear had been the key chord, though, there was no doubt about that. During those first 2 weeks at DNS, she had had the same dream over and over. She was sitting in one of the wicker chairs on the porch when a brand new red Sentra pulled up to the curb in front. The driver's door opened, and Norman got out. He was wearing a black T-shirt with a map of South Vietnam on it. Sometimes the words beneath the map said, "Home is where the heart is." Sometimes they said, "Homeless and have AIDS." His pants were splattered with blood. Tiny bones, finger bones they looked like, dangled from his earlobes. In one hand he held some sort of mask which was splattered with blood and dark clots of meat. She tried to get up from the chair she was in and couldn't. It was as if she were paralyzed. She could only sit and watch him come slowly up the walk toward her with his bone earrings bobbing. Could only sit there as he told her he wanted to talk to her, up close. He smiled, and she saw his teeth were also covered with blood. "Rosie," Anna asked softly, "are you here?"
"Yes," she said, speaking in a little breathless rush. "I'm here, and yes, I'm still afraid of him."
"That's not exactly surprising, you know. On some level, I suppose you'll always be afraid of him. But you'll be all right as long as you remember that you're going to have longer and longer periods when you're not afraid of anything, and when you don't even think of him." "But that isn't exactly what I asked, either. I asked if you're still afraid that he'll come after you."
"Yes," she was still afraid. "No, not as afraid."
She had heard a lot of his business-related telephone conversations over the last 14 years, and she'd heard him and his colleagues discuss a lot of cases, sometimes in the rec room downstairs, sometimes out on the patio. They barely noticed her when she brought them warm-ups for their coffee or fresh bottles of beer. It was almost always Norman who led these discussions, his voice quick and impatient as he leaned over the table with a beer bottle half buried in one big fist, hurrying the others along, overriding their doubts, refusing to entertain their speculations. On rare occasions, he had even discussed cases with her. He wasn't interested in her ideas, of course, but she was a handy wall against which to bounce his own. He was quick, a man who wanted results yesterday, and he had a tendency to lose interest in cases once they were 3 weeks old. He called them what Gert had called her self-defense moves, leftovers. Was she a leftover to him now? How much she wanted to believe that, how hard she had tried, and yet she couldn't quite do it.
"I don't know," she said. "A part of me thinks that if he was going to show up, he would have already. But there's another part that thinks he's probably still looking. And he's not a truck driver or a plumber. He's a cop. He knows how to look for people."
Anna nodded. "Yes, I know. That makes him especially dangerous. And that means you'll have to be especially careful. It's also important for you to remember, you're not alone. The days when you were are over for you, Rosie. Will you remember that?"
"Yes."
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
"And if he does show up, what will you do?"
"Slam the door in his face and lock it."
"And then?"
"Call 911.
With no hesitation?
"None at all,"
she said, and that was the truth, but she would be afraid.
Why? Because Norman was a cop, and they would be cops, the people she called. Because she knew Norman had a way of getting his way. He was an alpha dog. Because of what Norman had told her again and again and again, that all cops were brothers.
And after you called 911, what would you do then?
I'd call you.
Anna nodded. You're going to be fine. Absolutely fine.
I know. She spoke with confidence. But part of her still wondered, would always wonder, she supposed, unless he showed up and took the matter out of the realm of speculation. If that happened, would all of this life she had lived over the last month and a half, DNS, the Whitestone Hotel, Anna, her new friends, fade like a dream on waking the moment she opened her door to an evening knock and found Norman standing there? Was that possible? Rosie's eyes shifted to her picture, leaning against the wall beside the door to the office, and knew it was not. The picture was facing inward, so only the backing showed, but she found she could see it anyway. Already the image of the woman on the hill with the thundery sky above and the half-buried temple below was crystal clear in her mind, not the least dreamlike. She didn't think anything could turn her picture into a dream. And with luck, these questions of mine will never have to be answered, she thought, and smiled a little. What about the rent, Anna? How much?
$320 a month. Will you be all right for at least 2 months?
Yes.
Anna knew that, of course. If Rosie hadn't had enough runway to assure her of a safe takeoff, they would not have been having this discussion.
That seems very reasonable. As far as the room rent goes, I'll be fine to start with.
To start with, Anna repeated. She steepled her fingers under her chin and directed a keen look across the cluttered desk at Rosie. Which brings me to the subject of your new job. It sounds absolutely wonderful, and yet, at the same time, it sounds iffy, impermanent. These were words which had occurred to her on her walk home. Along with the fact that despite Robbie Leffert's enthusiasm, she didn't really know if she could do this job yet, and wouldn't, not for sure, until next Monday morning.
Anna nodded. They aren't the words I would have chosen myself. I don't know what words would be exactly, but they'll do. The point is, if you leave the Whitestone, I can't absolutely guarantee I could get you back in, especially on short notice. There are always new girls here at DNS, as you know very well. And they have to be my first priority.
Of course, I understand that.
I'll do what I could, naturally, but
if the job Mr. Leffert's offered me doesn't pan out, I'll look for work waitressing, Rosie said quietly. My back is much better now, and I think I could do it. Thanks to Dawn, I can probably get a late shift job in a 7-Eleven or a Piggly Wiggly if it comes to that.
Dawn was Dawn Vereker, who gave rudimentary clerking lessons on a cash register that was kept in one of the back rooms. Rosie had been an attentive student. Anna was still looking at Rosie keenly. But you don't think it will come to that, do you?
No.
She directed another glance down at her picture.
I think it will work out. In the meantime, I owe you so much.
You know what to do about that, don't you?
Pass it on.
Anna nodded. That's right. If you should see a version of yourself walking down the street someday, a woman who looks lost and afraid of her own shadow, just pass it on.
Can I ask you something, Anna?
Anything at all.
You said your parents founded Daughters and Sisters. Why? And why do you carry it on? Or pass it on, if you like that better?
Anna opened one of her desk drawers, rummaged, and brought out a thick paperback book. She tossed it across the desk to Rosie, who picked it up, stared at it, and experienced a moment of recall so vivid it was like one of the flashbacks combat veterans sometimes suffered. In that instant, she did not just remember the wetness on the insides of her thighs, a sensation like small, sinister kisses, but seemed to re-experience it. She could see Norman's shadow as he stood in the kitchen, talking on the phone. She could see his shadow fingers pulling restlessly at a shadow cord.
She could hear him telling the person on the other end that of course it was an emergency. His wife was pregnant. And then she saw him come back into the room and start picking up the pieces of the paperback he had torn out of her hands before beginning to hit her. The same redhead was on the cover of the book Anna had tossed her. This time she was dressed in a ball gown and caught up in the arms of a handsome gypsy who had flashing eyes and apparently a pair of rolled-up socks in the front of his breeches. "This is the trouble," Norman had said. "How many times have I told you how I feel about crap like this?" "Rose?" It was Anna, sounding concerned. She also sounded very far away, like the voices you sometimes heard in dreams. "Rose, are you all right?" She looked up from the book, Misery's Lover, the title proclaimed in that same red foil, and below it, Paul Sheldon's most torrid novel, and forced a smile. "Yes, I'm fine. This looks hot." "Bodice rippers are one of my secret vices," Anna said. "Better than chocolate, because they don't make you fat, and the men in them are better than real men, because they don't call you at 4 in the morning, drunk and whining for a second chance. But they're trash, and do you know why?" Rosie shook her head. "Because the whole round world is explained in them. There are reasons for everything. They may be as far-fetched as the stories in the supermarket tabloids, and they may run counter to everything a halfway intelligent person understands about how people behave in real life. But they're there, by God." In a book like Misery's Lover, Anna Stevenson would undoubtedly run daughters and sisters because she had been an abused woman herself, or because her mother had been. But I was never abused, and so far as I know, my mother never was either. I was often ignored by my husband. We've been divorced for 20 years, in case Pam or Gert hasn't told you, but never abused. In life, Rosie, people sometimes do things, both bad and good, just because. Do you believe that? Rosie nodded her head slowly. She was thinking of all the times Norman had hit her, hurt her, made her cry. And then one night, for no reason at all, he might bring her a half a dozen roses and take her out to dinner. If she asked him why, what the occasion was, he usually just shrugged and said he felt like treating her. Just because, in other words. "Mommy, why do I have to go to bed at 8, even in the summertime when the sky is still light outside? Just because. Daddy, why did Grandpa have to die? Just because." Norman undoubtedly thought these occasional treats and whirlwind dates made up for a lot, that they must offset what he probably thought of as his bad temper. He would never know, and never understand, even if she told him, that they terrified her even more than his anger and his bouts of rage. Those, at least, she knew how to deal with. "I hate the idea that everything we do gets done because of the things people have done to us," Anna said moodily. "It takes everything out of our hands. It doesn't account in the least for the occasional saints and devils we glimpse among us. And most important of all, it doesn't ring true to my heart. It's good in books like Paul Sheldon's, though. It's comforting. Lets you believe, at least for a little while, that God is sane and nothing bad will happen to the people that you like in the story. May I have my book back? I'm going to finish it tonight with lots of hot tea. Gallons." Rosie smiled, and Anna smiled back. "You'll come for the picnic, won't you, Rosie? It's going to be at Ettinger's Pier. We'll need all the help we can get. We always do." "Oh, you bet," Rosie said. "Unless Mr. Lefferts decides I'm a prodigy and wants me to work on Saturdays, that is."
"I doubt that." Anna got up and came around the desk. Rosie also stood. And now that their talk was almost over, the most elementary question of all occurred to her.
"When can I move in, Anna?"
"Tomorrow, if you want."
Anna bent and picked up the picture. She looked thoughtfully at the words charcoaled on the backing, then turned it around. "You said it was odd," Rosie said. "Why?"
Anna tapped the glass fronting with one nail. "Because the woman is at the center, and yet her back is turned. That seems an extremely peculiar approach to this sort of painting, which has been otherwise quite conventionally executed." Now she glanced over at Rosie, and when she went on, her tone was a bit apologetic.
The building at the bottom of the hill is out of perspective, by the way.
Yes, the man who sold me the picture mentioned that. Mr. Leffert said it was probably done on purpose, or some of the elements would be lost.
I suppose that's true. She looked at it for several moments longer. It does have something, doesn't it? A fraught quality.
I don't understand what you mean.
Anna laughed.
Neither do I,
except there's something about it that makes me think of my romance novels. Strong men, lusty women, gushing hormones. Fraught, that's the only word I can think of that comes close to describing what I mean. A calm before the storm thing. Probably it's just the sky.
She turned the frame around again and restudied the words charcoaled on the backing.
Is this what caught your eye to start with? Your own name?
Nope, Rosie said. By the time I saw Rose Matter on the back, I already knew I wanted the painting. She smiled. It was just a coincidence, I guess. The kind that isn't allowed in the romance novels you like.
I see. But Anna didn't look as if she did, quite.
She ran the ball of her thumb across the printed letters. They smudged easily.
Yes,
Rose said. Suddenly, for no reason at all, she felt very uneasy. It was as if somewhere off in that other time zone where evening had already begun, a man was thinking of her. After all, Rose is a fairly common name, not like Evangeline or Petronella.
I suppose you're right, Anna handed the picture over to her. But it's funny about the charcoal it's written in, just the same.
Funny? How?
Charcoal smudges so easily. If it isn't protected, and the words on the backing of your picture haven't been, it turns into nothing but a smear in no time. The words Rose Matter must have been printed on the backing recently. But why? The picture itself doesn't look recent. It must be at least 40 years old, and it might be 80 or 100. There's something else odd about it, too.
What?
No artist's signature, Anna said.